Welcome to Everything But The Tip, the podcast that bucks the trend of the mainstream golf content being churned out by the masses. Presented by the co-founders of Smart Golf and Fitness, we're on a mission to guide golfers towards genuine improvement. No swing tips, no shortcuts, we're anti-instant gratification. Join us as we navigate the complexities of the game, offering insights on how to truly excel in golf by embracing the challenges and breaking free from the usual quick fix mentality. All right, we're back for another exciting episode of Everything But The Tip. And I must tell you, I'm really, really excited because it's been a long time since it's only been Tommy and I in the room.
I showered extra.
He promised he was going to shower and hold. And you know what? We've got a couple of guests tonight. So
I got my hair cut. I shaved my beard off.
Is that for the episode or for the White Eagle member guest starting tomorrow?
That's for a lot of different items. My wife can only tolerate it for so long, so I thought it'd appease.
All right. Fair enough. I must say, I actually am genuinely excited because we do have two distinguished guests with us tonight. I believe we have... I think maybe two first-timers. Todd, we might have did an episode with you. I don't know if we actually launched it, but we got two first-timers. But both valued experts among the team here at Smart Golf and Fitness Instruction. First one I'd like to introduce is one of our longest tenured coaches and our lead golf instructor, a Mr. Todd Russell. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Our pleasure. In addition to Todd, we also have one of our esteemed golf-specific trainers, none other than Marissa Campo.
Thank you.
Guys, welcome to the show. We're very excited to discuss our topic, which I will now introduce.
Are either of you nervous, by the way?
That's a good question.
I mean, no, I'm always anxious, not really. But...
I mean, you're telling me? You don't have any performance anxiety?
A little bit, but not right now.
Well, if you can read between the line, listeners, the lines, we are going to discuss a subject in which actually both of them had told us, informed us, took the time to put some thoughts together on the subject matter of performance anxiety. And I think we'll soon find out. You guys can correct me if I'm wrong. It's something that is... definitely very personal and real and historically something you've experienced in both of your lives. So could I go as far as saying it's a subject matter that you're probably pretty passionate about discussing?
Absolutely.
Beautiful. Well, let's start off really simple here. Well, I would just, we won't go there yet, but let's start off really simple. And let's just, for our audience, define what performance anxiety is. And I'll start with Marissa. What is performance anxiety?
I mean, for me, it's always been a worry or not necessarily a fear of like going into an event or something I have to do. It's just like a worry, like what could go wrong? Like, why do I feel this way? Like, what happens if I don't do well? Like, it's just always like a worry in my mind, in like the pit of my stomach, like something could go wrong, something's gonna go wrong. Even if it's something I've mastered and done 1,000 times, I'm still anxious about it. And I mean, you could call it nervousness, you could, whatever you wanna call it. But for me, it's just definitely like the worry going into something that I'm about to do.
So
well, that's kind of exciting because that means it still means something to you. I think if that ever kind of leaves you, then it's kind of like, all right, you know, do you even enjoy what you're doing anymore? Does it even get you going? No.
Exactly.
Based on what I heard you say, could you go as far as saying it's for you a little bit of fear of failure?
A little bit. Like, I don't, and I'll get into this later, I don't like to let myself or people that have expectations around me down. I don't like to fail. I try to prepare myself 1,000% for whatever it is I'm going to do. But I mean, yeah, I would say I don't want to fail. I don't want to let people down. And like I said later, this goes back to my dad teaching me golf growing up. That'll get into later, but I would definitely say that's a big part of it.
So it's, in addition to, it's a definite concern and care of what other people think.
Absolutely.
Okay. No, that's real. That's true. I think a lot of our listeners can relate to that, and I look forward to discussing that a little bit more in depth. How about you, Todd? And, you know, obviously, I think she gave a pretty good definition, but I like how she made it personal to her. What is it for you?
Many things there that Marissa just said, like, very much resonate with me. And I know that if you were to look up performance anxiety in a dictionary, it's going to say something like, you know, extreme massive nervousness before you head out into an event that's important to you in front of an audience or in front of people.
I think that's literally the definition of this work.
Yeah. So, sure. I mean, for me personally, it performance anxiety goes back to the fact that it started for me with having actual anxiety in my life, and starting in my early to mid 20s, experiencing this sensations of like massive worry before I was going into fly on an airplane or going somewhere that was very high in heights, you know, being scared of heights, or these premeditated thoughts or ideas similar to what Marissa was talking about, and that what could go wrong in these situations that haven't even happened yet. And that's essentially what anxiety is you're playing this what if game of what if this happens? What if? And you're already predetermining outcomes and of situations that haven't even occurred yet. And many times for people with anxiety, those predeterminations or those outcomes are very negative very much on the wrong end of things of how you want them to turn out.
Yeah, I was going to follow up. You can have a ton of what ifs, but obviously what leads to anxiety, you're not saying what if it goes right? What if it goes well? What if I actually come out on top? It's always the exact opposite. Yeah, sorry to interrupt. You were going to add something, Tommy.
Yeah, I just love the fact that, you know, I'm excited to hear your experiences and talk a little bit about what there, but you both had two totally different like kind of definitions of what it was. Like Todd kind of, he focused more on some of the things that are out of his control, you know? I mean, you can control if you're going to go up to a place that's really high and, you know, whatever it is, but if you are someplace seeing, you know, sightseeing or hanging out with family or whatever it is, that's, you know, that's a little bit out of your control. You can go check it out, but flying an airplane, I mean, you're not the guy with in the cockpit there and stuff like that. So I love how, like, you know, Marissa's was kind of one side of things and you kind of covered the other side of things. So I'm kind of curious and anxious to see how those things, not anxious in a bad way, but anxious to see how those things come together and how your experiences are different. So.
And that's, you hit the nail on the head. And many times that people that are anxious, I know that I've experienced it, Marissa's talked about experiencing it, and that sometimes these things are in our control, but more often than not, the things that we worry about are actually out of our control.
So I think that would be a big part of our coaching here is making sure that our you know, students take control of as many things as they can when they get out on the golf course, because I'm sure we're going to relate this to golf here very shortly, so that, you know, when those unknowns or the things that are out of the control pop up, at least they put themselves in a solid position to overcome them and succeed.
Without a doubt, 100%.
Yeah, I think, you know, as we defined what performance anxiety it is, you know, it's ultimately, I think, extreme nervousness. It is an easy way to define it for this conversation. I think obviously it's the fear of failure. It's the, you know, in your case, you could say it's, you know, being exposed to a threat, or what, at least perceiving what you perceive as a threat. You know, that could be, you know, flying an airplane. For others, it could be performing poorly in a golf course. You know, in probably Todd's case, it's behind closed doors, you know. Sorry. Once I knew we were talking about that.
It's all good there. Fortunately for me, that's not the case.
I was waiting for the comeback there. Obviously, I had that one teed up prior to this episode starting. I mean, because even before we started, I'm like, you know what? I do want to have a definition for what performance anxiety is for our audience as we, you know, again, don't forget that the point of this episode is to relate to golfers, right? But Marissa, you know, I think you Googled it. And she's like, well, shoot, everything I Google about performance anxiety has to do with sex.
Yeah.
I'm like, absolutely. All right, well, Todd probably can relate to that. But anyway.
Cool. So there's obviously some different components that are related to it. I believe we're going to kind of go through and kind of break those down as we go. But this can really affect anybody, right?
I would say for anyone that cares, you know, and that's where I'll try not to get too sidetracked here. But for me, you know, I don't necessarily think anxiety has to be, especially when it comes to sport and performance, it's okay. It's okay to have it. It doesn't necessarily have to be looked at as a negative, right? Just because you have it in whatever discipline, whatever, you know, discipline, sport, jumping on a plane, whatever you're about to participate in, doesn't mean things are going to go wrong, right? And I don't want to hijack the conversation with this. I have plenty to say. I want you guys to lead this. But let's start. You guys did put a little bit of an outline together to keep the conversation flowing nicely. Marissa, I'll start off with you. Let's start, explaining to our listeners how some of the effects of performance anxiety that show up for different individuals. And we'll start with the very first one, and I'll let you kind of to lead the way there.
Yeah, absolutely. So I would say for me personally, the biggest one that hits me the most is physical tension. I can recall I was playing in Wisconsin Junior PGA Championship, so a very big tournament for juniors at the time. And for me, physical tension on the driving range for the first round, I shanked every single iron shot going into this round.
Now, at the time, as you were experiencing this, were you like, oh, shoot, I'm physically tense right now?
I mean, no, I'll say, like, for the record, I had no idea what anxiety was when I was in high school or playing competitively throughout college. I just was like, I had no idea what it was. Like, I knew nervousness was a thing, but I didn't really know it about anxiety until, like, 5 years ago, until I got diagnosed with it. And they're like, oh, you have anxiety. I'm like, great. It's awesome. So when I was on the range, I just thought there was something wrong with my swing. And my dad's, like, drilling me, like, this is what you're doing, this is what you're doing. And I, like, couldn't stop shanking the ball. So obviously I was, like, nervous, worried about how the round was going to go, just because my dad was so hard on me and his expectations were so high for me to be successful, play well, score well, place well, what have you.
Talk to me about the night prior to a tournament. As you're going to sleep.
I mean, going to sleep, there wasn't really much through my mind. Obviously, there's worry because I'm like, y'all don't know my dad. Like, love him to death. Like, even now, sidebar, he wishes he was not as hard on me. However, there'd be a lot of talk about, like, you know, what's going to go on tomorrow, like, how we're going to play certain holes, whatever. And then the night before, I just, you know, take myself to sleep, make sure I get a good night rest. I didn't do anything necessarily to prepare myself mentally. I don't know if even now there's anything I could have done. Just because a lot of my anxiety came, like, in round as far as the physical part. So
is it fair to say building up to a tournament then? Because, I'm trying to relate it to me a little bit here. You know, we've got a big four-day member guest coming up. Mm-hmm. You know, it could be the Smart Cup. It could be just another tournament that Smart Golf is putting on. For me, a lot of my anxiety is before the event starts. Mm-hmm. And I feel like that's relatable to a degree. I think once you're in the heat of battle, for me at least, I would kind of hopefully fall into flow. You know, you make your first mistake, that kind of takes it away a little bit. All right, here we are, we're in it. That's worst case scenario maybe. But I'm curious, so like, respect, I just want to confirm. So prior to, did your anxiety or any of the symptoms we're about to discuss, did they not kick in until the day of? Did you have were you not building up the anxiety prior to the event?
Here's the thing with me when I was playing very competitively growing up. I was fine going into it because it's either I'm either going to play really well or really poor. And if I play really poor, I'm going to have to hear about it for like 2 hours after the round. So like I leading up to it, it was like there's nerves. However, like during the round, if I'm not playing well, that's when a lot of these performance anxiety symptoms will kick in. So say I took like a double on my first hole. Well, I'm like, fuck. Like, now I got to talk to my dad about this for 2 hours. And now this is just going to be a train wreck avalanche after this. Oh, okay. Like, hopefully I even break 90 today. But if I start off well, then I get in a little bit more of a rhythm where I'm like, okay, now I have more momentum. Like, let's keep this going. But if it started out bad, it was a hot mess the rest of the round.
Tommy, I'm just going to piggyback off that real quick in terms of somebody that has suffered this massively over the last 25 years, 30 years, not only personally, but professionally. And that I think many times what happens is that people might perceive performance anxiety as, all right, you go into a tournament and you're very anxious when you're teeing off in this tournament. But, you know, once you hit a few good shots, then this anxiousness or this performance anxiety may start to go away. Well, for me, or somebody that suffers from this actual like medical diagnosis, like you start hitting a couple of poor shots and this starts steamrolling this effect of like, am I going to continue to hit these same poor shots time and time and time and time and time again? And then offsetting it with having some of the same feelings that Maris did in terms of like me being a people pleaser, and that I don't want to let the people that have expectations for me down. And by me hitting poor golf shots, I'm actually out here like embarrassing myself in front of people and people that have external expectations for me that I should be better than this.
So about, I want to follow up with Marissa, you know, talking about people who have expectations. It's clear for her, she's not shy about it, communicating it, stemmed from her father, right? Mm-hmm. Now, Todd, you talk about fulfilling people's expectations. Do you have, can you recall or pinpoint, you know, was there any certain individual or people or your friends or colleagues, you know, people in the business? Is there a direct moment in time or circumstance or set of people that you were concerned about meeting their expectations?
That's a great question, because I think my answer would be everyone. Everyone that knew me as Todd Russell, the golf professional.
Was it just Junior Shadow?
Exactly. And that I had internally created this expectation of what I should be to all of these other people around me, that they perceive me as Todd Russell, a professional golfer. And at the time I was out of college and trying to flirt around on the mini tours and actually play golf for a living for, you know, 2 or 3 years. So I thought that I had to be able to perform at this such massively high level to impress and quantify my abilities to all of these outside external people that had the same expectation for me.
And fulfilled what you'd been working for.
And fulfilled what I had been working for, yet as I've gotten older and learned the whole time that I wasn't doing most of that for me. I was doing it for somebody else.
Don't think you're alone with that. You know, for me, I can say once I become a PGA professional and I understood, or at least maybe even had my own definition of what that meant, especially when I'm playing with people from my hometown, you know, very small town, not a lot of guys necessarily move out and go become a PGA professional, and they all have their, you know, way of supporting or lack thereof. To where I went, especially even going and just playing a normal round with kids you went to high school. Oh, well, you're a PGA professional now, right?
You can't.
Right? But no, I think those are very relatable experiences. When Marissa was going on with her, I'm like, man, I feel like we should, you know, we could pivot this and do an episode about, you know, as a parent of an athlete, of some of the do's and don'ts, right? Because she's evident and willing to talk about it and be extremely transparent about how, you know, genuinely caring about your child's success and being one of their biggest fans, because I have no doubt that your dad is, how there are certain measures, tactics, you know, strategies that may have an inverse effect. Okay.
I want to hear how this round finished up, though. I mean, we left off with Marissa not even on the first tee, so her heart is racing on the driving range here. She's having a shank session going on. Muscles are tight. You know, timing's off. I mean, like, did you double the first one?
Well, so
me go ahead and be transparent. I went to the car and cried for like 15 minutes before, because I was like, I'm going to shoot 200 today. Like, there's just no way I can't do it. Let's just say I broke 80 that day.
Nice.
I went out there and just literally, like, it can't get any worse than this. I went out there with, I had a care in the world. Like, I didn't care at all. I'm like, it can't get any worse than the driving range. So I just went out and, like, I just laughed when I was done. My dad's like, what did you end up shooting today? I'm like, I think it was like 78 or 77 or something. I just laughed because it was just like,
no big deal.
He's like, why can't you go out there and, like, not care all the time? I'm like, is that serious? Is that a serious question really? Right now? Like, but yeah, it ended up well. But at the same time, like, that was one of the few times that I actually went out and, like, was not able to, like, not care about it. Because I was like, again, it couldn't get any worse than the shanks. So.
And I think that that represents, Tommy, in that so much of this is manifested in this narrative in our own brains that 80 or 90% of the time doesn't even play out.
Sure. So talk to me a little bit about how did you combat that physical tension? So, I mean, this is one of the few components we're going to talk about tonight, the physical tension that is related to, you know, performance anxiety. You said you went to the car and cried for a little bit, but like, was there anything else you did that, you know, that helped combat that? I mean, you said you went out there and didn't care because it couldn't get any worse. So a little different narrative you wrote there.
I think mentally at that time, I just went out and like didn't care, which I think physically for me made me relax because I was like, there's no point in getting stressed out over it because it was like I couldn't
you
do anything.
Were.
I was like, all right, well, might as well go out here and just do my best. But I'll say, like, even in the now when I go play, if I have performance anxiety and like physical tension, one thing I honestly do is like I'll monitor my breathing, and like if I'm on the first tee, I'll take like a bunch of deep breaths if I feel my heart rate is up. Just anything to really like bring myself back down to earth, whether it's even if I'm playing with friends or playing in some of our member day events, like there's a little like first tee jitters, but it's just like, okay, Marissa, you've played how many rounds of golf? Like, why are you so elevated right now with your heart rate? Like, what are we doing? So for me, it's just like really like grounding myself, breathing, getting through it. And just, like I said, bringing myself back down to earth at the end of the day.
That's kind of like Jay Day, doesn't he? Like kind of close his eyes and just kind of envision shots. Mm-hmm. So it can affect, you know, even the best players in the world.
It does massively.
Cool. Right.
So let's continue to go through. I think what might make sense is let's go through some of the symptoms of performance anxiety. That'll be easy for the listeners. And then there's, you know, a few items that I think we should discuss about, you know, especially with any book that I read regarding performance psychology and some of the messaging and some of the practices that they like to communicate, and then also dive a little bit deeper into some practices, exercises in which you guys were able to, you know, hopefully have worked for you to some degree. All right, so number two we got here, we talked about physical tension. You know, we've all experienced it, whether it, again, public speaking, first tee shot on the golf course. And number two, we have
lack of physical tension.
Yeah. Loss of focus. So what does that exactly mean, and how has that shown up for you, if it has?
For me, the loss of focus would be my inability to focus on the positive in the moment. So, you know, after going, the performance anxiety for me became more of a very quick triggered thing where I didn't get massively nervous on the driving range before I would play. I felt very relaxed and wasn't overly worried about my swing or my ball striking. I could go out on the driving range and swing well and strike the ball incredibly well.
Were you good the night prior too?
I was okay. I wasn't, I know you and I have talked about this a little bit, Joe, before in the past, and that most of my anxiety before I teed off on the first hole was in the days or the nights leading up to the event. So, you know, if it was an event that was massively important to me, then I'm slow walking my brain through all of these different scenarios of how these rounds could play out. And what if I started hitting it poorly, and how am I going to navigate through? And what are the people that think I'm a great player going to think about me and my swing and everything that you could ever, you know, go down the rabbit hole on?
What type of excuses am I going to create for why I played bad that day?
Yeah.
You know?
So, you know, to me, the loss of focus is that I had a really hard time in being able to focus on exactly what I was doing once I got set over the golf ball and not having the massive worry and fear that I was going to have the big miss.
And if you were to go just play with your boys, with your friends, you did not run into that similar experience.
Very rarely, because I was usually about 6 or 8 beers deep, and that did wonders for my performance.
Or we are not going to advertise that as a long-term solution to our listeners.
So, but honestly, in that, you know, so for me, that the performance anxiety created, and what we've talked about, is this full swing yip, so to speak, with the driver. And that where I had seen myself in these high pressure situations hit this high right shot off of the tee that I wasn't expecting to see. And then that implants in your brain of like, oh my gosh, what if I could hit this shot again? You know, and you're standing on the tee and you're standing over the ball and you're going, and then it manifests into like, I'm trying to pull the trigger, and all I'm feeling is this club face open and this high right shot that I saw when I was playing in a massive, you know, Illinois PGA match play event that was very important to me. So I can go back and define the, a time and a moment in a massive tournament where I hit a shot like that. And I still remember like the feeling and the fear that I had after that and started to, you know, germinate these feelings of like when you get on the tee box, you start to think about, I could hit this poor shot again, and then I could hit this poor shot again, and it just starts steamrolling into performance anxiety.
This is my new shot.
Yeah.
Where are you at today with that experience, and have you felt like you've taken positive strides in navigating that and being able to combat it to where you, for you as a golfer today, and how?
Yes, that's a great question, because I think many of our listeners, and I know from having dealt with this scenario personally and having this conversation with a lot of people, there's a far more people out there that deal with this type of stuff than we actually know, okay? Even from the best players in the world, there's zillions of good players in the world that deal with some type of pressure or performance anxiety. The professional athletes talk about it all the time. As for me, I would say that I'm far better now than I was 15 years ago when I was really competing and playing. I don't play in a lot of professional events anymore. As I start to turn 50 here in September, I'm going to start hitting that hard again. But I've started to learn that some of it was performance anxiety for me. And then I started looking back and going, man, could there be like a technical or a mechanical flaw in there that's actually causing me to hit this shot and not the flinch? And, you know, digging back a little bit deeper into that and starting to discover some of the mechanical flaws in my golf swing that combined with this negative pattern of thinking, you know, would set me up in these situations of like, you know, set up for failure before I even hit the shot. So what I have done and what I would highly suggest to other people is you can't continue to do the same thing over and over again and go through the same pattern and have the same swing and expect a different result in that situation. You've got to change something massively. Change your train of thought when you're stepping over the ball. I would go as far as like closing my eyes when I would be halfway through my golf swing, so that I couldn't anticipate when the golf club was going to hit the ball and flinch. Okay, it's called hit impulse. Hit impulse is the yips, basically. So what I went through and experienced was a form of the driver yips. I don't have performance anxiety when I'm hitting an iron. For me, it stemmed massively from hitting a driver and seeing how offline I could hit this driver if I made a bad swing. So I started going down the path of like, all right, I'm going to change something mechanically in my swing. I'm going to talk to myself when I set up in the golf ball and go through the swing so that my mind would be distracted. I'm going to close my eyes when I swing the golf club, you know, not the entire swing, but down at impact, close my eyes. I'm going to turn my head pre-impact and look at the target so that I cannot anticipate when the hit of the golf ball is going to happen. And I think a lot of this stuff and hit impulse for those of people that are listening is basically what the yips are. It's a neurological reaction of your body prior to the actual event happening of hitting the ball. And I know that there's a ton of people out there that have some similar struggles.
I might try chipping with my eyes closed this weekend if things go awry.
Yeah, and I want to go into it here shortly, just my thoughts and some of my experiences with the word choking, and tie that into the technicality, the mechanicals of someone's technique with whatever discipline that they're involved with. But I think, you know, what I want to kind of summarize here, if we're kind of hearing a common theme, I really care what people think, you know, one way or the other, that stems from anxiety. And then moving yourself into the future. And not only moving yourself into the future, but moving yourself on the negative side of the future. And, you know, if anyone's read any kind of books on mental performance, psychology, et cetera, Bob Rotella is a, you know, good writer, world-renowned sports psychologist, works with a lot of golfers. It's always a common theme throughout all this. I want to see how this hits home for you guys. I'm going to start with Marissa. But what do we hear and what do we preach? Hope you preach this to your students. If I have a student that's talking about some of the things that they can't control, right? We talk about controllables all the time, but where do they say anxiety comes from? For the most part, a simple definition: it's putting yourself in the future, usually looking at the potential worst case scenario in the future. But where does that remove you from? The present. What'd you say?
The present.
See, another reason he's my co-host. And that's the truth, right? We preach it and preach it and preach it about staying in the present. I mean, you've even heard it after individuals that have struggled with their own version of performance anxiety, whether it's in a PGA Tour event or, you know, another discipline, about how that they've had to put that in practice. Now, that's a whole deeper discussion, but being able to put yourself in the presence and stay there, especially in the heat of battle, that takes practice, just like changing the pattern in your golf swing. So I'm curious, when you hear talking about staying in the present, is this something that's familiar to you and has played a role in your efforts to try to navigate your performance anxiety, and how successful have you been?
Yeah, I mean, I wish that's something I would have started a long time ago. You know, Todd had actually referred me this book on anxiety. That's actually helped me a lot, kind of keep myself grounded in the here and now.
Do you guys remember the name? Can we give it a shout out?
What was the name of it again?
That could have a book.
Which
huh?
one? I got about a million.
I think it's like called Unwinding Anxiety or something like that.
Look it up.
But anyways, so now, like, whether it's, you know, golf-related performance anxiety, work-related, it's like I'll kind of step back and be like, okay, ask myself a set of questions like, why am I worried about what's happening in the future? Like, what's happening right now? Like, is there a reason for me to feel this way? Like, is this something I can control, not control, prepare myself for? If the answers are all like, just pointless, like, I have no reason to feel that way. So it kind of like brings me to the present of like, Mercy, you're fine. Like, you have nothing to worry about. Like, you've prepared for this. Like, you're doing great at what you do. Like, whatever it is, like, it's not anything. Like, I wish I would have thought this way when I was younger, but now it's like, say for example, I play around now, I might blow a drive into the trees. I'm like, okay, well, this is where I'm at now. Like, it is what it is. It's not like, okay, I get a redo. No, like, okay, this is going to make the hole harder. Not, oh my gosh, I'm going to take a double because I just blew it into the trees. I can still get a par from the trees. Like, it's not going to be the end of the world if I don't hit from the fairway. So it's like, when I play now compared to then, like back then I probably would have taken that double, but now I'm going to say, okay, like I might just make this more fun. I'll just have to hit this little punch under the trees. Hopefully it runs onto the green and I can still two putt for par. Where, like I said, back then it was not, that wouldn't have happened.
You guys ever heard, have you ever read I think it's the Little Red Book by Harvey Pennick? Mm-hmm. You know, again, as someone that can fully relate to performance anxiety still to this day, I love the one line, which is very popular, is, and this is paraphrasing, but he's like, your next shot could be the best shot of your life, right? So I always try to remind myself of that. You never know when you, out of the blue, get lucky and you chip one in, or you hit one in from the fairway, or you, you know, whatever the situation is, you get best case scenario mm-hmm. from that. And so for me, and I even preach this to my students, like, you're gonna hit bad shots every single time you play. You have to accept that, you know. And I'll just, you know, another little exercise so I can give this to the audience. I'll say, hey, depending on what your handicap is, and again, this might even be Bob Rotella. I don't even remember half of my knowledge where I got it from, because I'm not that smart, but I got it from somewhere. But I liked the practice of, okay, you're an 18 handicap. That's your index. Cool. Well, this particular exercise, they literally wanted you to stick like 18 pebbles in your pocket. I wouldn't do that per se. But know that before you play that you're going to get 18 bad shots, right? And you don't even have the right. This is a little bit different subject or topic because it talks about managing your anger, right? Mm-hmm. But you don't even have the right to get upset until those pebbles are gone, right? The reason I think that's relevant is, you know, going into it knowing that you're going to have bad shots, and that's just the name of the game, and that's golf, and that's okay. You know, another thing I just want to mention, because I don't know, you know, where all this conversation, where we're going to take it. I've decided to go off this itinerary. I like more about what we're talking about. Obviously, guys, we had a list here. You know, anxiety can have a lot of negative symptoms. And we did make a list. I will run through these real quick just so we can get this out. But we talked about physical tension. We talked about loss of focus. We talked about impaired decision making is one of them. Negative thoughts, physical symptoms, choking. Like I looked at this and I'm like, okay, we all know performance anxiety has some negative consequences. I don't even want to go through this right now. You know, but another thing I try to remind myself of, like, as we go play an event, and I've told you, like, I don't, once I'm on the tee and I'm ready to play, I'm going to play and I'm ready to compete. You get me a hole in, I'm ready to roll. Good or bad shot, that both takes my anxiety away. What I hated were the nights prior, the sleep prior. And I, as I get older, I'm starting to navigate that. But one of the lines I heard too is like, do you realize there are millions of people in China that don't even know you exist? Right? And again, it's a funny line. I could have picked any country.
Not for long.
But the point of that line is like, you're nothing. No one cares about you. Right? And there's a ton of people that have so much other shit going on in their life. Your measly round of golf, they don't care about. I think G4, they did a nice job with their hat, right? They have a hat. You seen it? No one cares what you shot. Genuinely, no one cares. So that's another thing I try to preach to my clients. I go, when you go play, and you get your playing partners and your opponents, how does their performance impact you positively or negatively? I don't give a shit. If anything, I probably feel better when they're playing bad, because especially if they're playing against me. But I sure as hell don't feel bad for them playing bad. You know, maybe as a friend, don't get me wrong, as a coach, like, we genuinely care about our players' games. You know, and I was guilty. I'd get done with a round, especially when I was really young and immature. I couldn't stop talking about the damn round throughout the course of a round. Tommy's been probably a victim of that, sitting in the, and all I want to do is talk about my game, about how I usually do this. I usually play to this level. And all that's the way my performance anxiety was culminating. I got to talk about it because I'm so concerned about my identity. I need to protect my ego. Without egos, people, we don't give a shit what people think about, right? So anyway, I wanted to mention that. I try to just, and I've helped players with this, just saying, I promise you, golf is a very selfish sport. It is a very, very selfish sport. Some of that's probably why we like it. Like, we're in control of our destiny. We do well, it's on us. Maybe a little luck. We do poorly, it's on us, right? And that's where I just try to remind them, especially beginners and other, you know, individuals that are new to the game. They have performance anxieties for, you know, similar reasons, like, especially as a beginner and you're working in the office, you just accepted a nice position and you're going out and playing with your colleagues. Like, the last thing you want to put yourself is an extremely humble environment. That's going to cause performance anxiety, mm-hmm. You know? So just try to remind people, like, listen, I promise you, they care about your game as much as you care about theirs. So again, I just wanted to throw that little tactic out there of how I try to help people deal with the part of the performance anxiety that comes from caring about what people think, right? Tommy, what do you have to say on that? Anything? Anything
turned over there? No, I'm just curious if either of you have like a specific experience that you can share. I mean, I really like hearing some of the anecdotes and things like that, and where you've experienced some impaired decision making, where you really started to second guess your club selection or anything like that, and then how you kind of got over that within a round.
Yeah, for me, Tommy, it got to a certain point, and you guys know, and I think when I started working here a couple years ago, and that I had taken the driver out of my bag. I had gone down to the old two wood. Yeah, the 2.5 wood. And, you know, for some reason it was, I could put that club down there and, you know, the smaller club head, and I could swing that thing with massive confidence and hit it 9 out of 10 times, nowhere near the high right miss and shape, and put the driver down and it, you know, back to the high right. So in terms of like my decision making, I needed to get to the point of like, all right, I'm going to hit this club that I know or I feel confident that I can hit right now. I'm going to go back to the drawing board and try to figure out and see if there's any technical flaws that are preceding this anxiety that I'm having before I hit these shots. And then in my practice and my training, I'm going to try to work my way through these technical flaws with the driver, so that I can start at least building up some confidence and start to take away that yip and that flinch.
Now, in some ways, could that not necessarily be classified as impaired decision making and actually help players to say, accept the truth, like what your strengths potentially are right now?
Without a doubt.
Yeah, and as a coach, you might, I mean,
I talk to my players about this all the time. I'm like, you know, is going through this process of hitting a driver, is it different than the golf swing you're making with these other clubs? Somewhat, and you know, there's some changes with setup and spine angles and things like this. But if you're going through this training and you have zero confidence in this golf club, and you're about to go play 36 holes, knowing that you have zero confidence in it, yet you put the 3-wood down and you're striping it, well, go play in the short term with the 3-wood and we're going to work through the driver.
Sure.
And that's kind of what I did myself. And the ego of gets in the way, and it's like I'm going out to play golf and everybody I'm playing with is hitting a driver and I'm hitting a 3-wood off the tee. You know, and you're questioning again, like, well, why don't you hit a driver? And it's like your ego gets in the way again. And it's like, I'm embarrassed because I have this perception that I'm a professional golfer and I should be able to hit all of these clubs absolutely perfectly. And yet I'm out here, you know, teeing off with a 3-wood because I have, a massive yip with the driver going. That was all like this self-predicated ego thing and perception of what other people had for me that ultimately spiraled into exactly what we have now, that it impaired my decision making, or on the flip side actually ultimately helped my decision making, and that I just can't hit this golf club right now because of a technical flaw. I'm going to hit a 3-wood.
Yeah, last time I checked, you didn't have to check in whichever club you were going to hit every time you made a swing.
So, yeah,
without so that's kind of cool. Yeah. No pictures in the course card.
So I think that my advice to my people and that I talk to and train every day is like, if you're going to play golf and you have zero confidence in this golf club, then usually it is the driver. You know, most people can navigate their way through a set of irons. Then let's find a golf club that you can hit solid and be very confident with, and we'll play with that in the short term.
Nice. Love that.
Question for Marissa. Is performance anxiety necessarily always bad? Does it mean you're going to perform bad?
And how can you flip it to be a positive?
Yeah, I mean, we can leave that as the question. I was just going to say, like, is overcoming it truly getting rid of it? And if it isn't truly getting rid of it, what does overcoming it mean?
That got super deep.
That's deep.
I thought we weren't bringing out the scuba mats tonight.
Let's hear the fuzz in our mics. I'm sorry if this ends up coming out to the listeners, but I keep hearing that fuzz. But whatever.
Okay.
You guys hear it?
It's your brain, Joe.
I mean, I would say, for me personally, it's not something I'll overcome and just be rid of it the rest of my life, where I'll just never feel anxious. I think for me, it comes down to preparation. Like, what can I do in the now so that I can be successful long term? I don't want to say control the outcome. However, I think for me, like, what can I eliminate now that won't pop up later? I don't like going into something with the unknown. How there always will be. But I think for me on the golf course, specifically contrasting playing now to back in high school and college when I play competitively, I'm in two separate mindsets of, like, so if I'm on the first tee now, I feel a little nervous, take my deep breaths and move on. But after the first tee, I don't feel really anxious anymore. So I'm like, I've prepared for this. I've practiced a lot all week. Like, however I play is how I'm going to play. Like, I can only control the outcome so much. And if I go out and I shoot a 75, awesome. If I shoot an 85, it is what it is. Like, I don't get upset about it anymore. I just, at this point, take it and run of like, okay, what can I learn from this round and change moving forward? So I think for me, I'll always have performance anxiety, whether I like it or not. It's just like, I just take different steps now to prepare myself to where when I get to set event, competition, whatever, I don't feel as anxious. It's just like, okay, I'm here. Whatever happens, happens.
Beautiful. Well, I love that because, I mean, that's what we're all about here is we're trying to help our students control as many variables as possible. So from the physical side, have you put in the work? Have you gotten your body ready? Have you eliminated any limitations that you have from a strength and mobility standpoint so that you don't have any mechanical flaws in your golf swing, that you could swing it, you know, the way that you want to swing it and do so successfully and efficiently? Have you put in the time? Have you done the deliberate practice? Have you worked on those areas of your game that needed to be worked on to fulfill those holes? Or have you continued to just go about what you've done in the past of pounding golf balls, hitting the clubs that you hit well, and things like that? And then secondly, having meaningful conversations, coming in, talking to your coach about what went well, what areas do you need to work on? And then, you know, again, you know, continuing down that path, having the trust in the process, having the trust in the team, and trusting that we're, you know, going to put you in a solid position to continue to work through those things. So again, you can't control the weather. You can't control how everybody else is going to play in the tournament. You can't control the course setup. You can't control all of those things. But if you take care of all the things that you can as much as possible, putting in that preparation, that work, you're just going to be able to better navigate those things that pop up because you know that you've done everything in your power to at least set yourself up for success from that regard.
Yeah, no doubt about that. And I know for Marissa and myself, having gone through this, that it's certainly made me a better golf instructor, without a doubt.
Definitely more empathetic.
Yeah, and that having lived through it and then going through and understand the emotions of, I know that many of my students are going through it, and how I've navigated through it is almost priceless to some of these folks that, you know, you can read all the books that you want, but when you've actually lived through it and have the experience yourself and you can pass that wisdom and knowledge on to other people is massive.
It's no different than having to go through and endure a long-term battle with a particular swing issue, having to overcome that and understand and experience what it actually takes to do that. That's also going to make you a good golf coach, right? Mm-hmm. You know, one thing that's helped me a little bit, and I mentioned it earlier in the episode when it regards to performance anxiety, I don't remember where I read it, but it just said, it's okay to have it. And just because you have it doesn't mean you're going to perform bad, right? And I think there's a lot of evidence in dialogue surrounding how closely related anxiety and excitement are, right? So I try to remind myself that anxiety also could just mean that you're really excited. Mm-hmm. So like, we're going to this White Eagle event, and it's like, you know what? I can choose to tell myself that I'm anxious, but I could also choose to tell myself that I'm really excited. Another thing I want to talk about or add to is, you know, you use the word preparation. That goes directly in line with what you can control, right? And I don't know if you guys just witnessed the interview kind of with Scottie Scheffler, and they were talking about him being nervous, talking about not necessarily verbatim of performance anxiety. He's like, listen, he's like, I either know, and he didn't say this, again, paraphrasing, I either know I prepared or I didn't. What's he focusing on? He's focusing on what he could have controlled prior to that, right? I am either prepared or not. So when I know that I've put my game plan together, I've allocated the amount of hours that I've set aside, I've put in the practice of each area in which I know that I need to prioritize, I did what I could control. Whatever's going to show up is going to show up.
And then I win.
Yeah. And again, and again, and again. You know, and I know, I think another key word we need to throw into this episode that goes along with what we have just highlighted, especially when it comes to preparation and control, and what I try to emphasize with my players, focus on the process, focus on the process, focus on the process, focus on the process. That's the same as staying in the present, mm-hmm. staying in the present, staying in the present, right? And that process could be pre-shot routine. It could be, you know, we've heard it, Vision 54, your think box and your play box, you know, setting aside two designated areas. Of, here's your think box as you gather your information, as you visualize the shot, as you're decisive in your decision making, right? And then how long you're allowed to spend in the playbacks where you're about to pull the trigger, whether you might be focusing on a breath, you might be target oriented, you might be focusing on what you're smelling, like it whatever works for you. And then even after that, all right, I know once I hit the shot, I'm going to accept my results regardless. You know, and I try to tell my players, if you hit a really good shot, don't ignore that. Mm-hmm. Bask in that. Dwell on that. Be obsessed with that. Let it bring a smile to your face. You know, and you know, this goes along with some of the messaging that we've sent in past episodes, but, you know, dwell on the good. Cement those memories in. Build that into long-term memory. you know, best performers, greatest performers, they have a long-term memory of the positive and a short-term of the negative, right? So there's routines and processes that you need to practice and train in all of those aspects as well. All surrounding for me to one key word. Well, there's three, but it's preparation. It's process and it's presence, PPP. And that's what I try to communicate to my clients on a regular basis. Don't try. I say this, like, go ahead. I think trying to overcome or defeat or eliminate performance anxiety is a losing battle. Accept it. Navigate it. Learn as much as you can with it. And know that it's not necessarily a negative thing. And it can actually elevate you and be a positive in helping you accomplish whatever you're trying to set out to.
Nice. I think we need to talk about choking.
I want to know. Oh, yes, I do have a lot to say, but I don't want to talk. I want Marissa to talk. So, Marissa, what do you have to say about choking?
Oh, my goodness. I can't recall a certain instance where I've, like, choked, whether it's playing basketball, hitting a last-second free throw, whatever. You know, usually my rounds are either really good or really bad. I don't feel like I can remember a point in time where I've, like, okay, pressure's on. If I don't make this putt on the 18th hole, you're not going to qualify for state. Or, like, something like that.
How about this? What's your definition of choking?
I mean, I feel like a scenario where you're under pressure to accomplish something and you crumble.
Cool. All right. We're on the same
page. I got a question for all of you because you played high-level golf. Mm-hmm. You two as, you know, esteemed Class A PGA professionals, like, what handicap would you say, like, you could actually start to talk about choking with? Because, like, you know, like, from my perspective and what I've heard several times is, like, majority of the golf population is not even good enough to qualify crumbling or doing anything under pressure or anything like that to be a choker. It's like that shot can happen. I know personally, I was in a club championship and, you know, we're coming down the stretch. It was a 27 hole event. And, you know, we're coming down to the last four holes and I had a significant lead early on. The guy I was playing against started to play really well and I didn't start to play poorly. I just started to revert back to my mean of what my handicap was. And I had a couple carts behind me and I hit a rare, very poor shot. And one of the guys was like, "Hey man, I've been in this position before." He's like, "You know, if we're not making you nervous, you know, let us know, you know, just concentrate. You got this, you got this." I'm like, "Dude, like, you're giving me way too much credit, man. I could hit that shot if I was out here by myself. I could hit that shot if I'm out here with my kids. I could hit this shot if I was in last place, first place, whatever, man. Like, you have no effect on what's going on." So my question is just, like, at what point, like, what level of player can you start to actually talk about choking, let alone just, like, that's not even part of the conversation?
You want me to go first? Okay. So we've talked about this in past episodes. I love that story, and I think you actually did a really good job at what I think people should relate to, especially as high handicap golfers.
Not that high anymore, can I?
Yeah, I don't know if I've put a numeric on it per se, but there is a book out there and it's literally called Choke. And then there's like a colon and it says something else. I probably should have had that prepared for this episode. But this book makes a case that crumbling under pressure, especially in a discipline and pressure like, or a discipline and challenge such as golf, they don't really believe in. They believe you're a victim of your circumstances, and more specifically in golf, your technique. So, and what I try to convey to my players, again, because I like to focus on what they can control, is we always talk about our philosophy. You know, our goal here is to eliminate the variables that shouldn't be there, solidify the ones that should be there, and make their golf swing as simple and as easy to repeat as possible. Well, this book goes on to make a pretty strong case to say you're a victim of your weakest link. Okay, so if you do have a golf swing that in any way, shape, or form is mechanically, you know, lack of a better way of saying it, not sound, and if you put your club in a position that requires some last second adjustments, okay, which is primarily most of the reason why people show up. A lot of us have them. Every golf swing has timing. Some just have a lot more. They're just a lot more challenging to time. But when you start to look at the guys that are, you know, way out of position in delivery and they've got a golf swing that has required a ton of that last second manipulation, well, once you are under pressure, just like if you take a chain, right, visualize the metal chain and you've got all these links, and you've got one that's got a crack in it, one that's got something, you know, wrong with it. Well, what's the first one that's going to break once the pressure gets strong enough? Well, it's going to break at the weakest area, right? That resonated to me, to where, like, to your point, did this guy with the most janky golf swing ever chank? Or did the pressure expose him and make his timing that much more challenging to repeat? That guy didn't choke. That's where I always make the joke. I'm like, that guy should have been more surprised than all the good shots that he hit that day. Mm-hmm. And that's where I think that falls on the line a lot with what we're trying to do here. If you train on your golf swing correctly and accordingly and appropriately, and you make your timing equation easier to solve, and you remove those weak links. Dude, I can't tell you how many times I've been on the first tee box in a tournament. I feel like I'm floating in the air, and somehow I pipe one down the fairway, right? And yeah, it's because I've worked my ass off my golf swing, and it is pretty sound. Doesn't mean I'm not capable of hitting bad shots, but I can tell you, to feel like I am not even holding the club, and if that my golf swing wasn't my golf swing, tell you what, that the last place that ball would have been was in the center of the fairway. So I don't know if I would go as far as putting a handicap on it. I would more associate it with how good their golf swing is from a technical standpoint, because let's face it, I mean, we've seen places, and I got to give them a shout because I love them, but Blake Denny had the worst golf swing I'd ever seen. Just kidding. I just wanted to throw that out there. I hope you listen to this episode. I love you, and it's so much better. But, you know, he was a damn good athlete. That's your props. He was a damn good athlete. To be able to go to break 80 with that thing. Wow. You know, but you put that guy under pressure.
Okay.
The chances of you being able to execute at the level that you had currently been executing are going to be dramatically diminished. And it's not because you choked. It's because your golf swing sucked.
I mean, to follow up on that a little bit, I worked in one of my past lives with a top 100 instructor, and I throw his name out there, Carl Robito, a good guy, great golf instructor. Used to teach a bunch of LPGA tour players and Chris DeMarco and up and down the PGA tour. But when teaching with him, and some of the LPGA girls would fly in for a couple of days and train with us, and they would have these conversations. Like, they're playing for a living in terms of, you know, if they don't execute on a golf shot and they don't make a cut, they don't make any money, and their, you know, family support, so on and so on and so forth. So Carl, being a master in psychology and amongst other things that he was, and he, you know, he termed it and said it in a way that resonated with me, and I still remember this to this day. And it's like, you're coming down the stretch of a golf tournament and you're a touring professional. So you're standing, if you're a touring professional and you're standing on the driving range and you're hitting 8 irons, okay, and let's call it 150 yards, you're 8 out of 10 times you're going to be able to hit the golf ball near 150 yards and probably within 20 to 25 feet of what your target is. Okay. 8 or 9 out of 10 times. The worst of those going to be still about the same distance and maybe 30 or 35 feet to the right or left of your target, on worst case scenario. So Carl used to talk to these girls or these athletes and be like, when you get that nervous and you're coming down the stretch, we always feel like we have to perform and execute, or overperform and out execute what we would normally do. And Carl would be like, all you have to do is hit your normal shot. Okay. You got 150 yards. If you hit your normal 8 iron, you're going to be within 20 feet of the flag. And when you hear it like that, it's like, I don't have to hit the best shot I've ever hit in my life in this situation. I don't have to hit it dead straight. I don't have to hit it perfect. I just have to hit my normal shot. What would be a normal shot for a 25 handicap? You know, they might normally not hit it within 50 feet of the flag. So,
a variety of shots.
There. Yeah. So it's not, it wasn't choking. It was just an example of shots that they generally hit because of technique and timing.
Yeah. The only thing I would add, it's not to say that you can't be your own worst enemy, that you can't, you know, potentially move to the future, especially if you're closing in on a tournament and you realize that, holy crap, if I hit the green and I two putt, I win. Mm-hmm. Right. So, you know, that's potentially inevitable. That would be a failure at the end of the day when you're analyzing your round. Like, holy shit, I got ahead of myself. Right. So I guess my point there is you can be responsible for adding external pressure to make the shot more challenging. You definitely can make it more challenging, right? To even execute a swing that's really sound, that doesn't have a lot of timing, and 100% have your execution be influenced. You know, then if you wanted to go play semantics, you could say, hey, maybe that guy choked because he got ahead of himself. He wasn't in the present. He didn't stay in the present. He allowed himself to get ahead. He allowed those thoughts to enter his mind, and he made the shot more challenging. Maybe it choked. Maybe. But again, I still think that comes back down to a message that I just want to be crystal clear within this episode. And it is ultimately like controlling what you can control, focusing on your preparation, staying true to the process, and staying in the present. Mm-hmm.
Did you see any mechanical breakdowns in Akshay's pod a couple weeks ago? Or is that just he was in a position that he hadn't really been in before and put a little too much pressure on that putt?
Yeah, as a player and even listening to his interviews, I would never allow a player, by the way, just from a pure growth mindset, psychological standpoint, I will never allow them to definitively say they ever choked, ever. Right? So in his case, he didn't choke. Dude, playing on the PGA Tour is hard, right? There's a reason that the three-footers aren't 100%. They're 99%, and the four-footers drop 10%, you start to like you another example, like I think that more people might even be able to reflect on is what just happened in the U.S. Open. Rory missed a couple, and if you want to go through and look at everyone that has an opinion on social media, what was a very common word you heard? Choke. I can't say I haven't talked to Rory. I don't know where his mind was. I don't know if he can admit and say, hey, I got ahead of myself. I was focused on the future. I put too much weight on this. Maybe.
You don't go to the putt. You go back to the approach shot, that little chip. You just didn't want to be above there. That was a slider. That's a hard-ass putt.
And well, the last putt, without getting too sidetracked, yeah, that was that was 10 out of 10 difficulty.
Absolutely.
And no, recreational weekend warrior is going to truly be able to understand and the significance about how challenging that putt really was, though they miss probably 70% of those themselves.
No, I love highlighting. I like highlighting those statistics because, Monday morning quarterback, sit behind your screen, protected by nobody can see you. But even the best in the world, like that stuff's not easy.
It'd be a question for Rory. Did you hit the putt you tried to? Because if you hit the putt that tried to, you didn't choke. Were you in a good mindset? Were you in the present? You've been preparing that forever. Obviously, it was heartbreaking for him. But all right, so I think we've done a pretty decent job at discussing this subject matter. I do want to give Marissa the floor again. And I don't know what's going through your head right now, but I want to give you an opportunity to just add whatever you want in regard to the subject matter and how it's influenced you, impact you, where you're at, what's the state of the union today for you, and kind of just give you the floor to discuss that.
When it comes to handling your performance anxiety, take your time. Like, one thing I found myself, I really have to tell myself sometimes to slow down so I don't have to deal with performance anxiety. I like to just be deliberate about what you're doing and commit to it. I mean, where I'm at now compared to college, long story short, after I got done playing, I was burnt out, started working full time. I actually stopped playing golf for 8 years. So when I moved to Chicago.
I have to follow up. Did you stop playing? Why did you stop playing? Did it have anything to do with performance anxiety and you were sick of that feeling?
I was burnt out. I went so hard playing, practicing at a collegiate level, high school. I started working full time and then, kind of found out golf is expensive. And I was like a broke, just out of college kid. And I'm like, I don't really have the means right now to do this. I don't have the time. And it just slowly kind of slipped away. And then as soon as I know it, 8 years later, I'm like, I want to get back into this. It's something I did have fun doing. It's not that I never did. It was just, at times it was very difficult for me to enjoy it with what I kind of went through with my dad teaching me to play. But now I'm just I want to do something for myself. So I started playing again. you know, after 8 years, it took a little bit to kind of get my life back together when it comes to my golf game.
Was playing it again, did that start when you started working here?
The summer going into it.
It's a recent.
Yeah. So within a year and a half, I would say. So I am playing competitively again. I will say it is a complete night and day difference of where I was at then to now. Like when I go and play now, whether it's competitively or with friends, like I just have so much fun, whether it's just like, even if I shoot a 92, 82, 72, whatever, like I'm in the same mindset. What'd you just
shoot, by the way?
I shot a 73.
Which is the first time you broke 80 in how long?
Since college.
Which is amazing. And you shattered it.
Side note, that's actually my lowest competitive round ever. Post playing 8 years.
Nice. We just want to let you know, we're going to give a shout out to Smart Golf and Fitness Instruction because she just started working here recently to end that drought of not playing. And yeah, another PR.
And it's funny because, like, during my PR, I was actually 2 under going into my 7th hole, and I took a triple. And I could have, like, really let that whole round go to shit after that. But I'm like, you know what? I'm still 1 over after going into my 8th hole. Like, it's not a big deal. I'm like, there's still a lot of birdies on the course, a lot of pars left. Like, I literally got done with that, and I just kind of, like, chuckled. I'm like, oh, that was fun. And then I just moved on, like... 10 years ago, that would have stuck with me the whole round. Like, I would have, instead of shooting at 83, I probably would have shot a 93. I would have completely fell apart. I probably, and this actually happened in high school. I shot in our state high school qualifier. I shot a 37.50 because I was playing well, fell apart, and I just never got it back together. But now it's just like, I get over it. I'll get a string of pars. I might take a triple, but then I'll get right back on the par train. It's a completely different mindset now where it's like, I just go shot by shot. I don't worry about the outcome. If anything, I'm like, okay, this will just make the hole more fun if I'm not playing well or playing for wherever. But I'll say it's definitely more enjoyable now because I kind of embrace the performance pressure of it and just, I don't know, I just have fun with it.
Let me ask you this. Is it fair to say, because we all know caring about something, right? We're all going to care about something and you could potentially care about something too much. And I try to like, you know, again, Bob Rotella, another shout out, you know, in one of his books called Putting Out of Your Mind, he's like, it's better to care less than to care more. One, would you say you'd go as far as you care less today? And do you think it's possible to coach someone to care less? And do you think that's a strategy that we would try to look for?
So I'll say I care more and I care less. So now I care less about the outcome. I care more about the process to get the outcome. Whereas before, I was just so concerned about the outcome that I couldn't even put myself where I was at in the present to even do anything or do a coherent golf round. Like now it's just like, okay, like I prepared myself for this. So like whatever the outcome is, it is what it is. Like I don't stress about it. I don't get upset about it. There might be frustration or like in the round if I'm like struggling, but it's not like a continuous battle and just an avalanche of shitty golf. It's like, okay, I might have 2 bad holes and then after that I'm fine, I'm not upset, I get through it. So I mean, I would really just, for all the listeners out there, take your time, keep yourself present, don't think about the outcome until you're done and you tally up your scorecard, because at the end of the day, like what you do 2 holes ago might not even matter at the end of the round. Like you could go on a birdie streak for all you know, and that double didn't matter. Like it, to me at that point, it's, I don't want to say it's non-existent, but.
I love that. And I just want to highlight, it's okay to care. You should care. Why are we doing this in the first place? But make sure you care about what you should care about, which is, and what you just highlighted and supported some of the messaging we were trying to share on this episode, which is the preparation and the process and not the outcome. Todd, I want to give you a chance to answer that. I do have some things I want to add to this, but I want you to kind of discuss, you know, your current state of the union with how you're navigating your journey with performance anxiety and anything else you would like as far as kind of your final thoughts on the subject matter.
Sure, yeah. So where I'm at is not only with performance anxiety, but anxiety in general. It's something that I will have for the rest of my life. It's you know, a medical diagnosis of having anxiety, and I can be at peace with that and understand that this is kind of just who I am. And I'm more like Marissa in that I'm kind of like okay with it and accepting that the performance anxiety and the anxiety is going to be something that I deal with every day of my life. And how can I navigate my way around this in terms of not only personally in my personal life, but professionally when I play. And what I've done is I've put myself to work on many things on the personal side, but also on the professional side of trying to purify the technique in my golf swing and actually going to work on my golf swing more than I have in 20 years, I would say. Joe, you've worked with me a little bit on some of the technique stuff, so you know in which terms I'm speaking of, but trying to get myself through the process, enjoy the process, understanding my own golf swing and my own flaws and my own technique far better than I ever have, so that when something does break down or when I do hit a bad shot or have a poor performance, I have a really good understanding of technically why did that happen. And that puts me at ease from an anxiety standpoint, because I don't get off. I hit poor shots when I play, you know, off the tee, and I'll hit the high right miss that I used to be feared of, but I can get back into some normalcy on the next hole, just simply basing it upon the mechanics and the technique of my golf swing and understanding technically what was causing that flaw. So kind of working backwards from I fixed the technique first, and as I've fixed the technique, it's gave me the confidence, which in tune is kind of fixed the performance anxiety.
Yeah, I love that. I would say to add, I think, you know, obviously in our assessments, we try to explain to our clients the timing equation. If you haven't listened to that episode, I don't even know what episode it is, but it's prior to this one. Probably titled The Timing Equation. But I try to just offer a little bit of peace of mind, right? If you know how your golf swing functions, how easy or challenging it might be able to time, and that, you know, it's inevitable for you to hit bad shots, and you know why, I do think that offers an opportunity for acceptance. And I think with acceptance starts to come, well, peace.
Sure. And what, you know, going back to anxiety in the beginning and the genesis of the word is the uncertainty. You know, anxiety is uncertainty, and performance anxiety and hitting bad shots and having the uncertainty of not even knowing why you hit that bad shot. You know, it circles back to if someone gives you the confidence and understanding of you knowing why that shot happened, it actually starts to reduce your anxiety.
I agree. I'm a pretty analytical guy, and I function in a similar manner. Tommy, I'm curious, you know, what, you know, I got one more piece of another nugget I'd like to leave the listeners with, but I'd like to give you an opportunity to, you know, to share where you're at with performance anxiety and any final thoughts you have.
No, I'm just a pretty confident guy. I mean, like I said, everything that you guys have kind of described, I've gone through. I mean, again, being a higher handicap golfer that's worked on their game over the course of the last few years, trying to, you know, eliminate some of those variables and get myself as best prepared as I can for events. I've actually embraced competitive golf now, but I still get anxious. You know, I mean, I've got a couple of instances over the last couple of years that every time I step on that first tee, including on Thursday, I just go back to my, you know, club championship qualifying round where there's 12 carts behind me because there was a lightning storm that came up real quick. And yeah, I mean, I might have hit two or three balls out of bounds. So I'm like, oh, I should probably just turn around and go back in. So that just, you know, it replays through my mind, but I utilize some of the strategies that you talked about. Close my eyes, envision a good shot, deep breath, go up there and just make a swing. Whatever happens, happens. I've also improved my club selection, my decision-making. It is a driver hole, but I hit 5-wood there now because 5-wood's going to take some of the variability out of there. I'm not going to hit it in somebody's yard. You know, Joe described the hole with the water on the left and the large bunker on the right. I'd actually love to hit that bunker. That would be fantastic. Or the rough next to it, because that means it's not in somebody's yard across the street or it's not in the water. So I can play that second shot. So again, you know, the thought process.
Realistic expectations.
Isn't always positive, but it's like I'm trying to do the best things that I can to remember the good shots I had there, put myself in the best possible position to succeed. Whatever happens, happens. We're going into a partner event. So if I don't play well on that hole, then I'm going to try my best to do it better on the second hole. But I love this episode just because gone through all of it, you know, I always think about, oh man, if I don't play well, what am I going to talk about? Oh, everybody's going to ask me, every one of my clients next week, hey, how'd you do in your memory gap? How'd you do in your flight? And you start to create a narrative in your head prior to all that. So I, you know, I still struggle with that, and I still, you know, I'm there for the camaraderie, I'm there for the food, there for the drink. Golf is a positive side note, and if we happen to play well and do well, that's great. So, but I enjoyed this episode because, like I said, it resonates with me, and I think a lot of the listeners will get a lot out of this as well. So,
awesome. Thank you for sharing. The last piece that I would like to share.
I've also been just falling asleep thinking about the last driver and the 220-yard striped 4-iron I had and the near eagle I had in the last hole I played on Sunday. So I just keep replaying that in my mind.
Did you eagle or near eagle?
No, I made a par.
Well, again, that makes me think of what is a Freddie Couples before he hits every single shot. Yeah. He thinks about the best shot he's ever hit with that club.
Yeah.
I think that's a good strategy. Now, one thing that I've started to discuss a little bit more with my clients and then, you know, also personally that I try to, I'm trying to create a habit of focusing on. We talk about different mindsets, right? Specifically here, we talk about growth mindset, okay? And I don't know if we've gone completely into an episode on that, but we're not going to use this episode for that. But a mindset that I'm starting to talk about more is called a grateful mindset. And I try to put a positive spin on performance anxiety to where I try to convince myself and clients that you're lucky to be experiencing it. Not everyone has something they really care about. Not everyone has the ability to go play a sport, let alone golf, especially with how challenging and how steep the learning curve is. Not everyone has the opportunity to go play in competitive events. We've got a lot at our fingertips, whether it's the IPGA, whether it's the member guest we host, whether it's the member guests we're being invited to, we're lucky. Golf is not an activity that everyone has access to. Just the fact that you're out there playing, you're in that environment, beautiful, perfectly mowed grass, you know, beautiful nature, might see a deer, whatever. Again, I'm getting older, I'm trying to get wiser, I'm trying to get more mature, I'm trying to focus on what's more important. The fact that I'm standing and I'm breathing and I'm able to play under pressure, I'm lucky. I'm very, very lucky. And anyone that has the opportunity to experience that is lucky. The fact that I care about something enough to where I feel this shitty, this sucks. I don't want to feel this. But damn, I'm lucky. I'm alive. I feel alive. Mm-hmm. And then what if it goes well? What if at the end we're hoisting some hardware? How good could that feel? How good of a feeling do I have the opportunity to potentially have? Mm-hmm. How good of a feeling is it to text my team at Smart Golf and Fitness that I just shot a 73, first time breaking 80 in 8 years? Not only did I break 80, I effing crushed it.
Yeah, we didn't even get like a group text on that or nothing.
Okay. Wasn't even on the Discord.
But nothing. How good is that feeling? And you don't know when the next opportunity or next, well, you're going to have plenty of opportunities. Every time you go out, there's an opportunity to shoot the best round you've ever shot your entire life. Why not focus on that?
Yeah.
Right? So these are the conversations. They don't sound too dissimilar to how I just articulated that I'm having with my guys. Right? You're talking to grown adults a lot early in my career. I've been on the planet a lot longer than I have. Let's not be grateful. Be grateful that you have this putt to potentially win. That you were able to be in the tournament to begin with. That you have the ability to hit a ball at all. And that's your hobby. I feel, honestly, I'm biased, but I feel sorry for people that don't play golf. Mm-hmm. And whether that's because they chose not to or even worse, didn't have the opportunity. I'm going to leave it off with that.
I'm looking forward to playing with Joe 2.0 and Grateful Joe. So.
Oh.
Bring him to the golf course.
I'll do my best. I'm still competitive as hell. I can't say I'm perfect. It's easier said than done. Do I have relapses? Absolutely. I already had one this year. But hey, you know what?
System.
I did get it out of my system. We're going to have a blast.
Grateful Joe. Sounds like a band.
Yeah. It's kind of like your favorite band.
Oh, yeah.
Well, it was just there. Grateful Dead. Vegas. 119 degree heat is
that's
what I
right.
heard.
hottest single day record in the history of Las Vegas and the hottest 10-day stretch in the history of Las Vegas. 118 degrees on the strip, baby. It was cooking.
Pass.
Beautiful.
No.
Well, I love this episode.
Thanks for having us, guys.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's awesome.
Overcoming your anxiety and joining us.
I think one thing that I'll end with is that, look, all four of us on stage here, two PGA professionals, the college collegiate player, and Tommy, who's got himself down to like an 8 or 9 handicap at this point.
Baller competitor.
And we all experience anxiety at some level. So the fact that in the masses, it has to be just huge.
Yeah, I'd say at the very least, just accept that it's okay.
Yeah, we all deal with it.
Come see us, we'll help you with it.
All right, people. Oh, wait, or does anyone want to give a... I don't know why we pretend every time we forget, but you got a tip for the audience? Anybody? Huh? Everything about the tip, what do we got?
Nope.
All right, well, no, I'll keep it simple.
I think you just come on in
here
to Smart Golf and take care of those variables that you can. So that you can better navigate that anxiety you might get when you're on the golf course. So be grateful for being out there.
Cheers.
Hit this.
Cheers.
Boom.
Cheers.
Boom.
Peace.
A big thank you for tuning in to another episode of the Everything But the Tip podcast. Stay connected with us on all social media platforms by following @SmartGolfFitness. For additional episodes, updates, and exclusive content, check out our website at smartgolffitness.com. Don't forget to show some love, like, share, and subscribe to ensure you never miss out on the latest insights and engaging discussions. Your support means the world to us. Until next time, keep swinging and stay fit.